This is Audible.
The Innocent Wife by Amy Lloyd. Read by Christina Cole and Lorelei King.
Prologue. The girl was found 76 hours after she was reported missing. The fingertips had been removed with cable cutter pliers, a calculated attempt to hide DNA evidence. The flesh of her attacker gathering beneath the whites of her nails as they dragged over his skin. Her body had been moved shortly after death. Wherever she was killed had been private enough for a prolonged and violent attack, followed by the mutilation of her corpse. Holly Michaels was dumped in the dark water of the bayou in the northernmost part of Red River County, Florida, 10 miles from her home. In the photos of the crime scene, she was lying face down. This made it slightly easier to stomach the first time Sam studied them, alone, in the unlit living room of her terrace house in Bristol. At first, the photo seemed indecent, not so much because of the gore, the blood matted into fine blonde hair, but the sight of Holly naked from the waist down. Sam wanted to lay a blanket across her to protect her modesty. Over time, she stopped flinching at the sight of her. The more she browsed the forums and saw it again and again, it became less about the body, the waxy pale skin and dark patches of blood, and more about the details around her. Now her eyes focused on the edges of the picture, the patch of ground circled with a red line. Sam squinted. It was a footprint. But as the forum members discussed, there were no casts of footprints taken or discussed anywhere in the files surrounding the case. The question started, was this footprint purposely omitted during the investigation? Overlooked? Or are we looking at evidence of some club-footed Red River police officer who potentially disturbed the crime scene? They debated late into the night, Sam unsure what to believe except for one thing, that whatever had happened, it left the real killer free. Her obsession started 18 years after the first documentary. Seriously, I know it's not your type of thing, but you'll love it. It's unbelievable. It'll make you so angry, her boyfriend Mark had said, his face lit up by the glow of the monitor. Sam was sitting next to him in his bed, in the house he still shared with his parents. As the story unfolded on screen, everything else started to fade away. At the heart of it, the boy, too young for the suit he wore in court, blue eyes blinking confused at the camera, alone and afraid. It hurt her to look at him, beautiful in an ugly room, harsh light and severe edges. His own face so soft with sadness. Dennis Danson, barely 18 years old, alone on death row. After the film ended, she wanted more. She wanted answers. I told you, Mark said. I told you it'd make you furious. Soon, Dennis occupied her waking thoughts and lingered on the edges of her dreams, always too far away to speak to or hold, his fingers slipping from hers. So she joined online groups, a dedicated fandom that pored over every photograph, witness statement, court transcript, coroner report, and alibi. They debated minute details until Sam felt exhausted but unable to stop, digging for a truth that could right all the wrongs that had led to this point. There were subgroups who passionately defended their theories. They suspected Holly's stepfather, or the sex offenders who lived in trailer parks on the outskirts of town. They drew comparisons with other unsolved murders across America, which conjured an image of a transient evil, a trucker fueled by dark fantasies, a man who lived by night and killed alone. Then there were the conspiracy theorists, those who thought the whole Red River police force were covering for a ring of local pedophiles who had some kind of hold on them. Sam believed it was simpler than that. A week before the murder, a short man had been reported outside the middle school. He'd been stopping the children as they walked past, asking them for the time. He said he'd lost his watch and asked if they would help him look for it, with a promise of a reward. A mother who was picking up her boys approached him, telling the police later that he had made her suspicious, that he had been acting cagey, his eyes darting as he spoke. He was unknown in the relatively small community and had fled the scene before the police arrived. The man's presence had left the parents feeling uncomfortable, and teachers patrolled the school gates each morning and afternoon as an added precaution. With very little to go on, the police filed the incident and put it to the back of their minds. No crime had been committed, and the man didn't return to the school. A week later, Holly was reported missing. On the message boards, they referred to him as the short man. The police interviewed the mothers again, and a composite sketch of the short man was published in the paper and posted around the town. But the search turned up no suspects and no leads. Eventually, the police dropped the line of investigation entirely and, seemingly under pressure to make an arrest, focused on other rumors. Still, the forums followed up the short man theory, comparing mugshots of recently arrested sex offenders to the police sketch. Sam read the threads obsessively and marveled at the investigative skills of the fellow posters, the way their minds could identify the clues that the police had once missed and create stories that seemed so much like the truth that had been missing. There were other forums about other cases with other victims. There were other documentaries and podcasts and TV shows. But Framing the Truth, the murder of Holly Michaels, was the one that spoke to so many people, that grabbed them and wouldn't let go. Sam read everything she could on the internet, signed petitions to get new evidence admitted in court, the footprint, a statement from a family member about the stepfather's alibi, and found the message board she now browsed obsessively. They were all driven by the desire for the truth, to free the man at the center of the case, a victim of a gross miscarriage of justice. The fans connected with Dennis on a deep level, in part because after his arrest over the years they watched him change from a troubled 18-year-old boy to the man he became in prison. There was something almost holy about him, the way he looked in bright white overalls, serene like a monk, his hands and feet bound together with eye-shaped chains, as if in some kind of penance. Though he never accepted the sentence and consistently protested his innocence, he was calm. "I don't want to think of it in terms of fighting," he said at the end of the documentary. "Fighting exhausts you. Fighting breaks you. I'm handling it. I'll get there." When his image faded from the screen, Sam felt a pull in her guts. Overwhelmed by helplessness, she felt the crush of all the unfairness in the world and wept. Sam felt that the people on the message boards were the only ones who understood. They'd all experienced the same sense of impotence the first time they watched Framing the Truth years ago and welcomed her to the community. Some were sarcastic. Where have you been? Welcome to 1993. But overall, she felt at home there and contributed as herself, shared her thoughts and feelings not only about Dennis, but about her personal life on the general discussion board. They were the people she turned to when Mark left. When she returned home to find the house stripped of his things. No note, only his toothbrush resting with her own, entwined like the necks of swans in the cup on the sink. The others on the message board soothed her, messaged her with their Skype details if she needed to talk, assured her she didn't deserve it. They were all she had. Most of the group were American, but there were British members who sometimes arranged meetups and events. Still, it was the Americans who drove the discussions and organized protests. Twice, Dennis had been given a date of execution and the members had gathered outside the Red River County Courthouse and the Altoona Prison, protesting and talking with the media to raise awareness of the cause. They slept in tents, handed out information leaflets, and collected signatures for petitions, until another group formed across the street with signs that read "Murderer" and "Where are the bodies?" The group shouted back and forth, and barriers were placed on the curb on each side of the street to separate them. Police officers stood in the middle, staring straight ahead with neutral, indifferent expressions. When Dennis was granted a stay of execution, the national media published photographs of the group crying and holding each other. Sam read through the blog posts and the threads about the protests and posted to the Brits in their private forum about how she would love to be able to do something that amazing, but it was hard living so far away. "They didn't really do anything," one member replied. "It's just the way the system works. People are on death row for 40 years and never get executed." So did they actually do anything to help? Debatable. It seemed to Sam that the British members were less serious than the Americans, that for them it was a hobby. On one meetup, they'd all visited the London Dungeon. Bloody waxworks posed in eternal agony with rusted medieval torture devices strapped to their necks. A chorus of screams played on a loop over the speakers. As the group shrieked and laughed, she'd felt a disconnect, as if they were more interested in the morbidity of the case than the human elements. To them, she thought, Dennis wasn't even a real person. It didn't break their hearts as it broke hers. There was a British cynicism, a poisonous lack of emotional investment that made Sam want to distance herself from them. She felt better surrounded by people who ached the way she did and needed to do something. The American members were the closest friends she'd had in years. She stayed awake to chat to them, her laptop perched on bent knees in her bed. A lot of them wrote to Dennis and scanned in the responses. Sam still felt an awkwardness about the familiarity with which they spoke to him. It took her months to write a letter and weeks more until she actually sent it. 29th of January. Dear Dennis, my name's Samantha. I'm a 31-year-old schoolteacher from England and I know you're innocent. It feels weird to write to you. I've never done this before, written a letter to someone I haven't met. I know people must write to you all the time and say the same things like, your story really moved me and I can't stop thinking about it. But your story really did move me and I really can't stop thinking about it. There are so many people out here, Dennis, all working hard to prove you're innocent. I wish I could help, but I just don't know what I can do. If there's anything you need, please tell me. Even if it's something small, I'll do my best. It feels strange to know so much about you and you to know nothing about me. So I'll tell you a bit, just so we can even things up a little. I live alone. My grandmother died 3 years ago and left me her house. So my mother hates me even more than she already did, if that's possible. Like you, I'm a bit of a black sheep in my family. I hope that doesn't sound bad. I mean, people don't understand us because we're different to them. Not because we actually did anything wrong. My grandmother always understood me. She was more like a mother to me, really. And I haven't healed from losing her yet. Maybe this is why your story hit me so hard. I'm newly single. It wasn't a good breakup. And I hate my job. Some days I wake up early and I can't even move. I just lie there wishing it could stay that inky light time of day forever. I'm probably saying too much, but it feels good to actually be saying it to someone. I'll understand if you don't write back. You must have so many letters. But I just wanted you to know there are lots of us thinking about you. We're all really excited about the new documentary. It sounds stupid to say, but as soon as I heard about it, I just felt this new sense of hope. Almost a certainty that this time you could get your retrial. Are you excited? Sorry if this is a stupid question. I hope I hear from you. You always write such thoughtful letters to people. They post them online. People really love to know you're doing well, in spite of everything. And I would love to write to you again, if you wanted me to. Yours sincerely, Samantha. She didn't mention it to anyone in case he never replied, and then didn't post about it when he eventually did, because she wasn't sure if this letter just felt different because it was written for her, or if it really wasn't like the letters he'd sent to everyone else. 4:14. Dear Samantha, sorry for the delay in writing you. You're right, I get a lot of letters, and it takes me some time to read through what is sent to me. But even though I have a lot of time, I do not reply to them all. Something about your letter stood out to me. I'm sorry to hear you are lonely. I'm lonely too. Carrie tells me about the support online. It's a great comfort to me. It's difficult to understand sometimes. When I was in school, we had one computer, and we would type in the coordinates on a screen and it would make this robot move around the classroom. It was really slow. I think it was supposed to be a tortoise. One day we came back from recess, and it was broken. The teacher didn't even ask who it was. She just said my name straight away. I didn't do it, but everyone thought I did. There. That's something you didn't know about me. I haven't written that to anybody. It is strange that people know so much about me. I think they know more about me than I do. Thank you for your offer, but there's nothing I need financially. Carrie, I keep mentioning her, but I'm not sure you know who I'm talking about. She co-produced and directed the documentary, and she remains a great friend. Visits and arranges for my commissary. I'm fortunate to have her. A lot of inmates don't have anybody. To answer your question, I am excited about the new series, but I have had my hopes up before only to be disappointed. So, I'm trying to remain level-headed. I would love for you to write again. I like the way you write. It's very sweet. I get some strange letters. I'm sure you can imagine. I'd like to know more about you. Please write, if you want to. Please recommend me books. That is always helpful. You don't need to send them, I will be able to get them. I hope to hear from you again soon, Samantha. Your letter brightened an otherwise dark day. Best, Dennis. She read it again. He told her something he'd never told anyone before. It felt like having a piece of him. She took the letter with her everywhere. Each time she felt lonely, she read it again. As the letters continued, she felt lonely less and less. It was like falling in love, she thought. More like falling in love than she'd ever felt before. There was no pretending to be too busy to reply, or struggling to appear aloof, or agonizing over the number of kisses at the end of a text message. It felt natural. Right. 9th of October. Dear Dennis. Now I feel excited every time I hear the letterbox or get home to see an envelope on the doormat. Is that pathetic? I just love reading your letters so much. I know you're just being nice, though. That photo of me is not great, but it was the most recent one I could find that wasn't completely awful. Lots of people love taking photos of themselves. They're called selfies. Ugh, but I just absolutely hate it. I didn't used to. It's not that I thought I was beautiful or anything, but my ex definitely made me paranoid about photos. There were things I didn't even know to hate about myself until he pointed them out. Oh, I'm doing it again. Moaning. I'll stop. They've delayed filming again. Must be so frustrated. I want them to get on with it. The sooner the better. I know you're curious, but I don't have to be. I can just fully believe for the both of us. The nights are drawing in here. This is when it used to be the hardest, being alone. But now I don't feel so lonely anymore, knowing you're there, waiting for your letters. It's so good to have someone I can be honest with. When I'm teaching, I have to fake this strength all the time, or the kids just go feral. It's exhausting. I don't really get along with the other teachers. They're all married with kids. They look at me like there's something wrong with me because I'm not like them. I couldn't tell them about writing to you. They wouldn't understand that either. I saw one of them reading that book about your case the other day, When the River Runs Red by Eileen Turner, and I almost said to them, I know Dennis Danson. We write to each other every week. But I knew it would end up being gossip. Besides, there's something nice about people not knowing. Love, Samantha. 10:25, Samantha. Your ex sounds like an idiot. You are beautiful. If I were your boyfriend, I wouldn't be stupid enough to let you go. I've put your picture on the wall. You have such a beautiful smile. When I look at you, I can't help smiling back. I read When the River Runs Red. Eileen still writes me. It was weird to read about myself like that. I haven't seen Framing the Truth, but from what Carrie tells me, it's comprehensive, whereas Eileen's book is more sensational. Sometimes I didn't recognize myself. It made me sound weird. Yes, it's frustrating about the new series, but Carrie tells me it's for the best. There are legal hurdles to jump before filming starts, and I've had meetings with my new lawyers that give me some hope that a retrial will take place in the next 12 months. Everything moves so slowly. Each day here is like a week. I didn't get my outside recreation today because of rain, and my head is hurting again. I've read your letters many times, and when I read them, I am less lonely, as if you are here. I admit I'm starting to like you as more than a friend, Samantha. I can't help it. I look forward to your letters, too. Every week I search for yours in the bundle that is delivered to me, and when I find it, my heart beats faster. I'm almost sure I shouldn't tell you this. I worry that I'm only going to be a burden to you, Samantha, that the commitment of writing to me each week is too much, and that our friendship makes you more solitary or secretive. But I'm too selfish to stop. You make everything more bearable. I can't promise you anything. You deserve better. I'm worried you will figure this out soon and forget me. Love, Dennis. 13th of January. Dennis. Don't talk like that, ever. I love you. You're all I want. It doesn't matter to me that we're far apart right now. I'm happy. But I've been thinking, and I want to visit, if you'll have me. I still have a lot of the money my grandmother left me, and there's not much keeping me here. I was saving the money for something special, and I can't think of anything that would mean more to me. It's time for me to stop wasting my whole life wishing for things and actually do them. I know you'll say no, but I don't accept that. I know what's best for me. I've made up my mind. I could leave as early as next month, just say the word. All my love, your Samantha. 124, Samantha. The idea of seeing you here has lit me up too. I can't stop moving, pacing. In the yard, I ran circles and the ground threw dust up my legs. The guards laughed and they all said you must be something special. No one ever sees me like this. I hope you don't mind, but I gave Carrie your name and address. She will be filming in and around Red River starting in April, and I would like it if you could meet. At least I know she can look after you, even if I can't. Of course I will love you when I see you. I worry you won't love me. I've changed. Gone slack. But I'm working on it. For you. I'm older. I think people forget this. Some men still write to the 18-year-old I was. Love letters. I'm sure you can imagine. And I don't want you to be shocked when you see me in chains. They make us wear them when we leave our cells. They say it's for safety, but, well, it's humiliating. I won't give you the word. Come when you're ready. Come when Carrie is here. But come. I need you, too. I love you. All my love always, your Dennis. Subject, Dennis. Sam, this is Carrie, Dennis's friend. He gave me your address, but I figured it was easier to track you down online. Nice nudes. I'm just kidding. I didn't find anything weird. Anyway, Dennis talks about you a lot. I'm kind of sick of hearing about you. Nah, honestly. I haven't seen him like this in years. With you and the new series, he's like a new man right now. He tells me you're coming out here to visit, and he wants me to be your guide. I'd be super honored to entertain you while you're around. I'll be filming most days, but I thought you could come along if you're into it. We'll be going around Red River shooting some interviews, following some leads we have, witnesses, that kind of thing. Heard you're a big fan of the doc. Thanks. So maybe you'd like to get involved. Let me know. Any friend of Dennis is a friend of mine. If you need any advice on where to stay, eat, avoid like the fucking plague, then I'm your guy. See you soon. Carrie. She booked the flights before she could change her mind. When she left, no one even seemed to notice she was gone. Altoona. 1. The prison was a vast gray concrete monstrosity, surrounded by a razor-wire-topped chain-link fence. On the way in, Sam passed a plaque embedded in a large stone that read, Department of Corrections, Altoona Prison. Then under a Disney-esque archway, there was a sign with big plastic capital letters, Altoona Prison. The few palm trees scattered around the edges of the compound made it look even more surreal, like a film set. The hot, moist air smothered her skin and steamed up her sunglasses as she threw open the door of her rental SUV and vomited onto the gravel. It was like drowning every time she left the crisp, air-conditioned interior of her car, and her hair stuck to her skin, curling around her neck like tentacles. There wasn't much in her. She hadn't eaten since she flew in from Heathrow the day before, apart from a granola bar she bought from the motel vending machine in the middle of a sleepless night when her stomach clenched and gnawed. What came up now was stringy bits of stomach bile and coffee. She had mints, which rattled in the travel tin as she held them. She checked the mirror again. She thought, maybe I'm one of those people who think they're ugly, but really they're beautiful and they can't see it. She flipped the visor back up and said to herself, body dysmorphia, you wish. Then shook her head quickly to get rid of the negativity. She parked the car and walked towards the guarded entrance. She paused, thought about turning back. Over the past 24 hours, she changed her mind a million times. None of it had seemed real until she'd walked into the wall of heat outside the airport doors. Oh, this was a mistake, she told herself, an expensive and terrible mistake. Their letters had been a kind of shared madness, just two people wishing so hard for something better that they manufactured it themselves. Inside, she handed over her visitor's pass and identification, watched her handbag roll through an X-ray machine as she walked alongside it through a metal detector. They were briefly reunited on the other side before a man took it away and gave her a numbered ticket in return, as if she were checking her coat at the theatre. One female guard patted her down, another stuck a numbered sticker to her chest. People gently pushed her in the right directions, saying no more than one or two words, until she arrived in a long mint-green room, stiflingly hot, a small rattling fan in a corner. There were green plastic chairs bolted to the floor. Sam sat in the first available one. In front of her was a thick plastic window with holes around the level of her lips, a small shelf like a desk, and privacy screens to each side. None of the visitors, almost exclusively female, spoke or looked at one another. Sam peered through the plastic window. The opposite side of the room was empty, apart from one guard standing against the back wall, staring at his shoes. There was a door on the far right with a light above it, framed in a cage. For a second she wondered why, and then it hit her. The reality of the place she was in, the violence. Men so dangerous they had to cage the lights, screw down the chairs, bulletproof the glass. When a buzzer sounded, the light came on, red, and the guard's head snapped up. He caught Sam's eye and she smiled. He did not smile back. A memory when she was a teenager at a Take That concert. She'd leaned towards her friend and they'd clutched hands with breathing the same air as Robbie. The air fizzed with Dennis's presence somewhere out of sight. Inmates shuffled in, their ankles and wrists in the cuffs Dennis had described in his letter. Fingers crept over Sam's spine. Her stomach felt as though it was floating away from her. She thought about running, looking back at the heavy metal door through which she'd come in, locked. She realized she was trapped, that the only way out of this was to get through it. It'd be over soon, she reassured herself as the men filed in. And then, there he was. Different from the others, softer somehow. He'd put on weight, she noted, which made her feel better for a second, before he turned his head and she saw his profile, all contours and cheekbones. He was wearing a pair of fake gold-framed glasses, the lenses tinted brown so she couldn't make out his eyes with the way the light reflected from them. When he saw her, he smiled, and she waved in a way she regretted, loose-wristed and undignified. She tucked her hands between her knees. His ankles were chained and he took only small steps, like ones taken in the dark. At the window he stopped, shrugged. "Humiliating," he said. "Sorry? For what?" I didn't hear what you said," Sam said, pushing her hair away from her face. "I said this is humiliating," he repeated, sitting, the chains clanking against the table in front of him. "Chains? Like a junkyard dog?" "Oh! No, don't. I can't believe this is actually... I know." They sat quiet. "Weird, isn't it?" Sam tried. "What?" "This." "Yeah." She looked at him, and it was as if he were a stranger. Sam felt cold and exposed, wanted to turn and leave. But the sensation passed, leaving her head ringing as if she'd been slapped. He smiled. She covered her mouth as she smiled back and cleared her throat. "I'm sorry. I don't date much," he said. Sam laughed appreciatively. "Actually, me neither." "When did you land?" "Yesterday," she said, thinking of the first mouthful of Florida air as she left the airport, the moment it all became too real. "Good flight?" "It was okay. They feed you all the time to stop you getting bored." "Like here." It was gone. All the warmth of the letters. Sam blamed herself. "When are you meeting Kerry?" he asked. "Tomorrow," Sam said, thinking of how insistent Kerry had been that she join the crew while they filmed the new series. She didn't want to feel she was in the way, but when Kerry had probed and asked her how else she would spend her free time here, Sam hadn't been able to answer. "You'll love her." Sam felt a twist of jealousy and knew it was all still there, that she still loved him. "She seems so great." She pulled her lips into a smile that didn't reveal her teeth, which were too small, or her gums too big. She really is. You know, I don't really get many visitors. Carrie tries, but she lives so far away, and... Dennis let the unfinished sentence hang between them, and they sat in silence for a moment before Sam felt words tumbling out of her mouth. It's my fault. I'm shy, and my mind has gone completely blank, and I don't know what to talk about because everything seems so insignificant, you know? I just feel like a complete idiot. So hot in here, and I'm jet-lagged, and it's not you, it's all me. I'm sorry. Dennis looked at her, face slack, surprised. You're not an idiot, he said. And you know, I love you, you know? It was as if something broke inside her. I love you, too. You have something, he said, pointing to his right cheek. There? She pulled a strand of hair away from her face and relaxed. Thank you. It got a little easier then. He spoke excitedly of the extra visits he'd received lately, of new lawyers with bespoke suits and tailored strategies, of the new series, A Boy from Red River, and Netflix, which he understood only abstractly. Of new director Jackson Anderson, fresh off the back of a trilogy of blockbusters, who spoke with complete certainty of Dennis's release, as if it was an inevitability. He told her about Carrie, how he knew she wanted the best for the film, but how he could tell, after all these years, that she hated playing second fiddle to a man. She'd always been the one in charge, no question. Dennis laughed. She's pissed, but also, she knows Jackson can take this further than before. It's a money thing, she knows that. She'll still be doing most of the legwork. Jackson had brought an increased level of publicity to the new series. Celebrities tweeted their support, their fans downloading the first film, interest snowballing. Suddenly the message boards had been overrun by new names. Angelina Jolie wore a t-shirt with Dennis's mugshot on it, and underneath, hashtag Free Dennis Danson. He was trending on Twitter. He wouldn't have known any of it but for the influx of new letters, more than he'd ever received, too many to read. I'm starting to think this is it, he said to Sam. This could be it. Me too, she said. The whole world knows now. Everyone is on your side. She wondered, how could one judge fight off the whole world? There'd have to be a new trial. There was a buzz. The people around her leaned in to say goodbyes. Some pushed their lips against the dirty window, breathed to their loved one on the other side. Guards turned their heads. I have to go, he said. I know. Next week? Of course. Den, I love you. I love you too, Samantha. As he left, she blinked away tears, feeling a burst of pleasure from his voice and the pain of seeing him go. She pulled her dress straight. As she allowed the row of people to filter past her so she could join the back of the exit line, a woman behind her spoke, close enough to her ear that she felt breath tickle her neck. You like child killers, huh? I'm sorry? Sam turned, smiling, sure she'd misheard. Got a thing for guys who kill little girls? I saw who you were talking to. The woman had curly red hair that looked crispy with hairspray and a t-shirt that hung off one shoulder exposing her bra strap. Sam looked around for the guard, but the guards at either end of the room were occupied. I got family from Red River and they all know what he did. They know who he is. They know more than some movie can tell you. The woman spoke so softly no one paid them any attention at all. I'm not arguing with you, okay? I just want to leave. There was a shake to Sam's voice that she couldn't control. He tell you where the bodies are? That's all we want to know. Let those girls rest in peace. Let the families rest. They were the only two in the room now. Do you get off on it? Is that it?
Let's go. Time's up.
The officer placed a hand on the small of Sam's back and pushed her gently.
Bitch,
the woman said finally. The guard moved his hand away from Sam and took hold of the woman's wrist, a smirk on his face as he walked them both out.
2. Extract from When the River Runs Red by Eileen Turner. The Danson family lived on the outskirts of the county where the last remnants of civilization gave way to the backwoods, miles of land unsuitable for development. It was the type of land that got sucked into itself after storms, swamps that led to mangrove coastlines, tangled roots and water so black you couldn't see anything under the surface. The family lived 2 miles from town, down a dirt road that became inaccessible after periods of heavy rain. And as a boy, Dennis had walked over a mile each day to reach the school bus, often muddy and soaked through by the time he arrived. Even by the standards of Red River, Dennis was considered poor, and his neglect was recognized early on by his teachers. Though intelligent, he was often tired in class, and his clothes were dirty, or his schoolbooks went missing. Child Protective Services were called, and the house inspected. It was described by the social workers as unfit for human habitation, taken from Caseworker Notes 1981, and Dennis was sent to live with a foster family while his mother and father were given time to clean and renovate the property. His father, Lionel Danson, was advised to begin a 12-step program for his drinking, while his mother, Kim, was medicated for depression. Dennis returned 6 months later under the supervision of a social worker who would visit twice weekly for inspection. The visits lasted a few months before tailing off. The caseworker assigned to the Dansons later admitted he believed the family were coping and decided phone calls would be sufficient to check on their progress, as it was time-consuming to drive all the way out there each week. Statement from caseworker during investigation into practices, 1991. It wasn't long before the house returned to its former squalor, and his father returned to his usual drinking patterns. By then, the upheaval seemed to have caused a shift in Dennis's behavior. Formerly quiet and shy, he started to act out in class, was prone to sudden outbursts of noise and violence, to standing up abruptly and flipping the desk or screaming in the middle of the test, as if he found the silence and stillness of the room unbearable. Teachers who had once wanted to protect him, who'd found his blonde-haired, blue-eyed shyness appealing, now pushed him away, suspending him, sending him to stand in the hallway or outside the principal's office, while they focused on the children that could be helped. It was an isolating existence. Through elementary and into middle school, Dennis arrived alone, spent days segregated from his classmates, and went home by himself. As he entered high school, he became more intriguing to his peers, less of an outcast and more of a misunderstood loner. He was popular with girls, though he didn't date much, and started as a running back on the football team. The Red River High School football team were decent players but underfunded and lacked any real dedication. The coach testified for the defense at Dennis's trial, describing him as kind of a lone wolf but a good kid, taken from court transcripts May 1993, who just needed a little discipline in his life. Coach Bush was an important witness, a respected man within the community, who could confirm Dennis was with him at the school between 4 and 5 the day Holly went missing. The last time she had been seen was riding her bike away from her house at roughly 4:30. It meant Dennis couldn't have taken her, or at least the timeline should have cast his guilt into reasonable doubt. But when asked to provide the roll call for that practice, the coach was unable to do so, though he had registers for all other practices dating back a year, and the prosecution called another player who couldn't recall Dennis being at the practice that day either. Several boys remembered him being there, but others thought he left early. He usually did, they said, as he wasn't one to hang out after the practices or games. He was popular, but formed no close friendships with the other players. Instead, he spent most of his time with other misfits in the school, notably Howard Harries, son of Officer Eric Harries, and Lindsay Durst. This was something his team and his classmates couldn't understand, why he still felt so attached to these perceived losers. But this, the defense's psychologist argued, was a classic symptom of abuse. Dennis feared being exposed and vulnerable to his peers, that they might see what his home life was like. Court transcripts. Dennis couldn't escape the feeling he was a loser, even if, outwardly, he wasn't perceived as such. Life at home was becoming increasingly difficult. Twice, Dennis found his mother unconscious after an attempted overdose. His father was a violent drunk. When he was away from the house, Dennis could relax. But when he returned, he would beat Dennis for the smallest of infractions. Once, Dennis recalls, he had been eating his food in the TV room, sitting cross-legged on the floor, when his father appeared behind him and punched him in the back of the skull. Dennis spat the mouthful of food onto the floor, and as he turned to ask what was going on, his father hit him again in the mouth, kicked him in the stomach, unhooked his belt, and whipped him 3 times. "You were chewing too loud," he said eventually, breathless and sliding the belt back through its loops. Framing the Truth, Florida, Carrie Atwood, Patrick Garrity, 1993, VHS. To earn money, Dennis took a job at a retirement home cleaning rooms and washing clothes. Over time, the residents started to enjoy his company. He was funny and quick, they said, never spoke down to anyone, always listened. He helped organize the entertainment and events, served food, and talked with some of the people who didn't have as many visitors. Some of the residents showed him their keepsakes. He saw photos and medals and furs. They showed him jewelry. As he cleaned rooms, he saw shoeboxes under the beds belonging to the residents who didn't trust banks. At first, he only took a few $100 here and there. Enough to squirrel away for a plane ticket, a month's rent in New York or Los Angeles, food. Next, it was jewelry, which he took to a pawn shop for a disappointing amount of cash. Then a resident's daughter visited and wanted to borrow her mother's antique brooch for a wedding. The brooch was tracked to the pawnbrokers in town, and they told the police straight away. Dennis Danson sold it to them. "I wasn't thinking. I needed to be gone. At the time, I figured, you know, there weren't really any victims. That stuff was just sitting there waiting for them to die and their shitty families to come and sell it off." Dennis sighed. "I guess if I knew that everything I ever did in my life would one day be analyzed like this, like everything would be used as evidence to decide if I was a monster or not, I would have lived differently."
3. "So?" Carrie asked Sam, eyes on the road ahead of her. "How was your first date?" Sam laughed. She'd barely stopped smiling since their visit yesterday. She slept well for the first night in days, and when Carrie came to pick her up at the motel for the drive to Red River, she was waiting outside, eager to talk about it all. "It was good. It went well." Sam tried not to ask if Dennis had said anything, her instinct to appear aloof still strong, even after traveling across the globe just to meet him. "Is that it? I'm not going to tell you what he said until you give me a little more than that." "Fine. At first it was awkward, and I think that's my fault, really. I just got a little overwhelmed, I suppose. But he was so sweet." "Right?" "Completely." Sam got along easily with Carrie. She was short, with thick brown hair that stopped just above her chin and stuck up wildly when she ran a hand through it. "And, you know, he's handsome and stuff, obviously." "Obviously." "I was so gutted when I had to leave. It was like we'd only just started to get to know each other outside of the letters." Sam didn't mention the woman, the confrontation. There was a silence.
"And?"
Carrie teased.
"Stop it! Oh my God!"
Sam burned. What she felt for Dennis felt so different to the last time she'd started something new, to that secret fumble at the staff Christmas party, to Mark telling her quietly, "I'm not looking for anything serious, no strings." And she'd said, "Yes, of course." Because what else could she say? His hands already inside her clothes, months of longing and shy glances culminating in this, sliding his fingers inside her, painful, too soon, her body stiff and cold with the effort not to cry. "Are you okay?" And she said yes, because he had to be. Okay with being fucked, but not wanted. Okay with being a consolation prize. Okay with being okay.
"Well, he thinks you're totally hot, obviously," Carrie said. "He said that." His exact words were, "Samantha's totally hot."
"Seriously?"
"And he loves your accent." He was bummed out it had to end so soon, too, but he's really excited about seeing you next week. "It's so cute, I can't even handle it. My little Dennis finally dating."
Sam committed his words to memory. Tried to hear how he would say it, only half listening while Carrie told her about her first visit with Dennis, how scary walking into the jail for the first time had been. She talked about the death threats and hate mail she received, how they hadn't been able to work up any funding for the first documentary, so she and her co-producer Patrick had to work nights just to get it made. "You put me to shame," Sam said. It was essentially totally selfish. It was a story that needed to be told, and so we made the film. Like, I always cared about Dennis, right from when Patrick first told me about the case. Of course, everyone thinks I'm in love with him. She rolled her eyes. A woman wouldn't make a documentary about a guy otherwise, right? The fact that I'm gay doesn't seem to matter. I get it all the time. It was just the case. It seemed so unfair. This kid who obviously didn't do it. I couldn't get it out of my head. Sam thought of how close they were, how Dennis spoke about her. It's so overwhelming, though. I can't even believe I'm here and all I'm doing is visiting. It's like a really weird holiday, she said. It's huge what you're doing. Before you, Dennis was really starting to give up. It's amazing you came out here. Don't put yourself down. You're a strong woman. Sam flushed. I hate that, though. Strong woman. What does that even mean? Like, a strong man is a guy who can drag an 18-wheeler along by his testicles, but a strong woman is, like... Carrie clicked her fingers, searching for what she meant. A mum who petitions for a new road sign after her son gets knocked down by a boy racer? Right. Maybe that's less stupid. Well, yeah, when you say it out loud. But you know what I mean. It's some bullshit thing people always say. I mean, you're brave, is what I mean. Sam opened her lips to protest, but remembered how Mark had said she never accepted a compliment and it drove him crazy. Item number 13 on the list of reasons he couldn't love her. She turned to Carrie. Thank you. The houses in Red River weren't uniform like the ones Sam had seen as the plane came into land, with pools like surgical dishes and terracotta roofs. It was as if they were all built one at a time by people who ended up there by accident. The streets were wide and the houses spread apart. There were discarded sofas and chained up dogs that barked as they drove past. There was a town hall, modest and white, and a central street with a convenience store, a hardware store, and a diner. Most places were closed, with wood panels bolted over the windows. They drove onto a prettier area where the streets were shaded by large trees, and the houses were painted different pastel shades, with love seats on the porches and big shining SUVs outside. They pulled up next to a pastel yellow house, smaller than the others, the paint starting to peel around the white window frames. The mailbox read, Harry's, 142. According to Carrie, Officer Eric Harry's had declined every request for an interview during the making of the first documentary in 1993. On this occasion, he had contacted Patrick when it was announced Jackson Anderson was producing a new documentary series about the case. The lure of celebrity, Carrie said, rolling her eyes. Of course, he set us some serious restrictions. Carrie explained that if they even contacted Howard, his son, for an interview, he would see to it that their footage would never be released. He wasn't exactly dedicated or talented enough to rise up the ranks, but he still holds a lot of sway in this town, Carrie said. Honor amongst thieves? No one understands that better than cops. The interview was crucial, as Officer Harry's was the first cop to interview Dennis after Holly's body was found. When asked why he called on Dennis, he had testified, "Call it a hunch. Cop's intuition." The nerve of the guy, Carrie said while they looked at the house from the car. I've got serious questions about his story. They stepped outside and Carrie unloaded equipment from the back of the car onto the sidewalk. She had a camera, which she loaded onto her shoulder. She put her eye against the viewfinder and scanned the street, Sam instinctively ducking as if its gaze were a bullet. Carrie held the camera by a handle on top and cradled it from beneath, sweeping it around in a semicircle. She attached a pair of headphones, which she hung around her neck, and took a step back, cocking a hip to one side. So, how do I look? Jack wants us to be on camera now, like we're part of the story ourselves? I don't know. I feel like I'm on fucking Catfish. Inside, the rest of the crew had already set up and were adjusting lights, rolling a blind up and down, while Officer Harry sat in an armchair, pinching to release the top button of his shirt, the collar tight around his loose neck. Sam noticed that he looked at Carrie as she entered, but looked away again quickly. A gangly man emerged from the kitchen, ducking slightly under the doorway, and introduced himself as Patrick, Carrie's business partner. Together they had researched and filmed the first documentary, acquiring a small team as the story grew. Patrick seemed to Sam a little shy, his handshake limp and palm moist. He talked without looking into her eyes, asked a few questions. How was your flight? But he didn't seem to engage with her answers. Good, good, he said. Excuse me. When Sam turned around to talk to Carrie, she was gone. And so she stood awkwardly at the side of the room and waited for someone else to approach her. There were five people Sam didn't recognize, all busy setting up. A man swooped a boom mic over her head, apologized. She watched them, shifting her weight from one foot to the other and starting to grow flustered with self-consciousness, feeling as if she didn't belong. It was suddenly preposterous that she was here. You can take a seat, you know, Harry said from his spot. No, thank you, Sam said.
You look a little flushed. Do you need a drink?
He made to stand up until Sam waved him down. She needed a drink, but not from him.
Well, if you need anything.
With disgust, she noted the nose that swelled red with years of drink, open pores, and the nick of a razor crusted with blackening blood on his cheek next to his moustache. His forehead was already shining with sweat, his belt buckle sinking into a gut which shone white through the gaps in his shirt. Officer Harris cleared his throat.
That an English accent I hear? How do you like the weather? Hot enough for you?
Sam smiled politely, closed lips.
You move here? Or did you travel just for this?
Just visiting.
What did they bring you here for, then? You must be pretty good at whatever you do if they flew you out here.
Well, actually, Sam dared herself, feeling the tingle of confrontation. I'm a friend of Dennis, actually. More like a girlfriend. Harris's smile dissipated, and he sat taller in his chair. They don't got killers in England you can date? Sam turned and walked away, back out into the wall of heat outside. Suddenly it seemed as though everyone in the house was thinking the same thing. It made her sick, like she was spinning. She had to close her eyes and count her breaths, and remember who she was, what she was doing, why. She was standing in the shade, trying to bring herself back, when Carrie passed and handed her a bottle of water, dripping from the melting ice of the cooler in her trunk. Sam held it against the back of her neck and explained to Carrie what had happened.
This guy is the actual fucking worst, Carrie said. Don't worry, we'll tear him a new asshole. He said we couldn't speak to Howard. He didn't say we couldn't speak about him.
She coaxed Sam back inside. Sam stayed at the back of the room, as far away from Harry's as possible, watching him sip from a cloudy glass tumbler and wipe his wet lips with the back of his hand. Half an hour later, Carrie took a seat opposite Harry's, an iPad balanced on her knees along with some notes, which Harry's asked to see before they started. Sam watched his eyes move over the pages, smiling to himself, a cluck every now and then.
Happy?
Carrie asked him as he handed back the papers. He nodded. Carrie gestured that she was ready. Patrick called for silence and counted down. Carrie started.
Can you tell us about your personal relationship with Dennis, Officer Harris? About his friendship with your son, Howard?
I didn't have any kind of personal relationship with Dennis. But he was around a lot. Started when he was, seven, I suppose. Howie was always a caring boy, and he saw Dennis as a kid in need, so he would play with him in the yard. Kid was always in here eating all our food. I used to say to him, don't your folks ever feed you? Well, I guess they didn't, because he was always hungry, dirty, always stealing things. Though Howie would never say it was him, I knew it was him. $10 here, packet of cookies there. Nothing big. You ignore these things at first.
You never asked Dennis about it, or visited his home to see if he was being properly cared for?
We all knew what was going on at that house. Wasn't a secret. Not much you can do. I go round there and give his daddy a warning, and what happens? They probably stop him coming round. Howie won't forgive me. Those boys, they were inseparable. I had my concerns right from the start, but...
What were your concerns?
Howie was so impressionable. He was always trailing behind other kids his age, never invited to the parties or to play ball games in the summer. So I was suspicious when some kid like Dennis starts hanging around. He seemed whip smart to me. Shook my hand like he was a grown man the first time I met him. Then Howie started cussing, and I knew he got that from him. Broken toys buried in the garbage. Howie snapping his wrist after some stupid stunt, jumping off a bridge into the river. I knew who made him do this stuff. I saw him change him. But how can you take away your boy's only friend? So I've looked some things. I made exceptions. I had a quiet word with Dennis. Told him, now I don't want a bad influence around my son. You need to adjust your attitude or you can't come round here day in, day out. You hear me? Did it work? Week later, my vehicle was vandalized. A key scratched right down one side. I asked him, but he denied it. I always suspected him, though. That was my mistake, letting too many things slide. Watching my Howard get dragged into delinquency. Carrie sat forward, frowned. Some people see it the other way round. Teachers say Dennis was better behaved before he met Howard. Some locals say Howard was always a problem child. Ever since his mother left, he was, quote, out of control, end quote. Harry's grunted. Well, whoever said that was an axe to grind. Howie reacted badly after his mother left. Who wouldn't? He was a little loud and prone to tantrums, but he was slow with language. He just got frustrated is all. By high school, Howard was dealing drugs. Was that just caused by frustration, too? That was Dennis's doing. Did Howard tell you that? No, he didn't need to. It was obvious. Where would Howie even get? Look, Howie wasn't the brightest kid. He was covering for someone. He was a pleaser. He just wanted friends. There's no way he was capable of orchestrating something like that himself. But he swore it wasn't Dennis, even at the threat of expulsion. Like I said, he wanted to cover for his friend. So did you resent Dennis? No. Not even after your son was expelled and sent to juvie for 9 months? Not even then. Because some people say you had an in for Dennis after this. That it was you who knocked on his door after Holly's body was found? Though there was no reason to link him with the crime at all. Harry's took a breath. He was still calm, still composed. We had to investigate everyone in the area who had a record for sexual misconduct. Right, the public exposure charge you pushed for? What everyone recognized as a football prank and you insisted was sexual deviancy? I didn't insist on anything. Dennis exposed himself in front of teenage girls. He was thrown naked from a moving car after the football game and had to run back to the gym. The same prank had been pulled every season. But I wouldn't know about that, as I only know what's reported. Some of those girls were very upset. We had to do our jobs. Sam clenched her fists, cracked a knuckle. The boom mic guy turned and shot her a look. To Sam, right then, Harry's looked every part the villain. There was a shape to his lips. A not-quite-smile that suggested he didn't believe a word he said and that he wanted them to know it. He rested his hands on his thighs, tapping the tips of his fingers while he spoke. "What about the real flasher?" Carrie asked, looking through her notes, then back at Harry's. "A man was reported for exposing himself to a group of girls at a cheerleading camp on the Saturday before the murder. The girls were interviewed and described the man as short, dark-haired, and a little pale. And a police artist drew this." Carrie held out an iPad. The drawing looked undeniably similar to that of the short man seen outside Holly's school the week earlier. "Yet, months later, you spoke again to these girls and you showed them pictures of Dennis. You asked them if he was the man they'd seen. You interviewed them again, even after they had said no, and you pushed until one of them said maybe it could have been him. We felt we had compelling evidence that Dennis was our guy. But this picture couldn't look less like Dennis. You don't get accurate descriptions from people who are in shock, and when you're dealing with children, what made you think Dennis could have murdered Holly Michaels? We had a witness who heard him outright confess. We had fibers from a carpet that matched the one in his house. Those fibers
According to our forensic specialist, are present in roughly 7 out of every 10 households in America? That's hardly compelling. When you combine it with the witness statement, a fantasist.